Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm here in New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. We're here today with Dr. Han Vermeulen. He's an alumnus of Leiden University in the Netherlands and a research associate at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Halle, Germany. In 2015, Dr. Vermeulen published Before Boas, The Genesis of Ethnography and Ethnology in the German Enlightenment. Last year, this study was published in paperback. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Vermeulen. What prompted you to study the relationship between ethnography and ethnology in the German Enlightenment? And why does your study complement conceptual history with the historicist emic paradigmatic approach in a comparative framework? Also, why does your cover feature Peter Chaplin's 1729 map from the first Kamchatka expedition?
Well, the research that led to my book began in Leiden, the Netherlands, where I was studying cultural anthropology, or ethnology, as the subject was called at the time, previously. It was renamed in 1953, and I studied there in the 1970s. I was doing research on the history of this field, and in 1982, I found data that suggested that ethnology had emerged earlier in the Netherlands than in France, Germany, and England, which was puzzling. I found a manuscript of a lecture by the director of the Royal Dutch Chamber of Curiosities, Van der Kastelen, which was titled On Ethnology and held in 1830. This was earlier than some of the data from Germany, but also France and England, where ethnological societies had been established in 1830, 1839, and 1843. I had these data from about England and France from American British sources, such as George Stocking particularly, and it was very unlikely that the Dutch would have preceded introducing this subject, because the Netherlands is a small country with an interesting political system, one of the first republics in 16th century Europe, a great navy and a long colonial history in the East and the West Indies, but not a country where one would expect ethnography and ethnology to begin. More like traders and businessmen, seafarers than explorers or anthropologists. So I dived into this puzzle, checked all available sources in the library at Leiden, where I was studying, and I found a promising lead in a German encyclopedia that the term ethnology, in fact, the German word for it, Völkerkunde, which means ethnology in German, had been introduced at the University of Göttingen in the 1770s, that is 60 years earlier than my Dutch source. And this encyclopedia entry led me to an article by Hans Fischer, a professor in Hamburg, whose sources I checked and checked, and I found an even earlier source than Fischer a couple of years earlier. And that gave me a story that was completely unknown to anybody in the West, ethnology, which is a prominent science in the European and American history, had been invented by German historians during the Enlightenment, and nobody knew about it, except for Fischer and a few other Germans, like Justin Stagel. And this confirmed the importance of Göttingen as a center for anthropology, which was known in the work of the American historian of medicine, Erwin Ackerknecht, who had claimed in 1955 that Göttingen was a center of anthropology. However, he did not mention ethnology. And Ackerknecht was obviously unaware that the Göttingen historian Gatterer, the Göttingen historians Gatterer, Schlözer, and Heere not only discussed ethnographic details in their work, but also outlined a study called Völkerkunde or ethnography. And then, of course, later I found references that their work of Gatterer, Schlözer had been preceded by fieldwork-based research by explorers working in the Russian Empire. But that was in 1969 when I attended the conference in Halle, East Germany, after the fall of the wall. So this is how the study that led to my book began in the University Library of Leiden. And I was very much impressed by the magnitude of sources that they have. It took me years to digest it all and see some kind of pattern, namely that there hadn't been a study called anthropology, but that ethnology had developed next to it, parallel, so to say, and that all traces led to German historians working in Göttingen and previously in the Russian Empire. Now, the picture that on the cover of my book that you're talking about shows the itinerary of the first Kamchatka expedition, which was conducted in 1725 till 1730, the first Bering expedition. And it's illustrated with what one would call ethnic types, drawings of representatives of ethnic groups in traditional attire, with significant animals and objects such as snowshoes, a sledge, bow and arrows, and so, etc. And although that expedition had no academics, in contradistinction to the second Kamchatka expedition, it clearly had an interest in these ethnological topics. And this is what set me off, the fascination on I found it symbolic for the interest at the time in the ethnological studies of peoples around the world, and not only in Germany or not in Europe, but in the world at large. And when you say I needed the method, I partly borrowed this from George Stocking, who was also, of course, a master in historicist and contextualizing history of anthropology. And I adopted his method in order to make a distinction between my approach and his approach and the presentist attempt to write history, explaining events from present-day interest, which are usually anachronistic, of course. I coupled this historicist method of Stocking with the emic perspective of Kenneth Pike. You know, emic is an account of human behavior in terms meaningful to the actor rather than the observer. And the definition of paradigm suggested by Lakatos. A paradigm is a research program, hence historicist emic paradigmatic approach. And this is what I applied and found the most useful. To give one example, this ethnography, ethnology, it deals with the coining of the concept Völkerbeschreibung, 1740, Ethnographia, 1767, Völkerkunde, 1771, Volkskunde, 1776, and Ethnologia, 1781, which implied a paradigmatic shift from the study of manners and customs that was part of an older research tradition towards the studies of peoples and nations, as indicated by these terms. And this is based on an emic statement by participants, which need, of course, to be contextualized. These peoples and nations were no longer seen as characterized principally by their manners and customs, but by their languages, even if manners and customs remained a key aspect of culture, as defined by Edward Tyler in 1871, a century later. In addition, my motivation to pursue this research came from the conflation between nations and races, a serious issue that is also discussed in my book, both in the introduction and the concluding chapter and so on.
Now, what was the importance of anthropology before the 18th century, thus before the emergence of ethnography and ethnology?
Well, anthropology, as such, was a Renaissance study. It was invented by the humanist in the 16th and 17th century before it surfaced in the 18th century. The concept itself, anthropologia, surfaced in humanism, in the work of humanists at Leipzig in 51, Rome 1506, Paris 1516 and 1557, London in 1593, and Hanau in Germany 1596. These are six occurrences only in the 16th century. And it's always used in as a term to denote a discourse on man dealing with the human body and soul. It occurs in the work of physicians, theologians, philosophers, but not in the work of historians. And these six references to 16th century anthropology, which generally define it as a discourse on human nature, natura humana, this is interesting that it's totally different from what I see happening in the 18th century. Of course, the term anthropology was then frequently applied, especially in the 18th century, mainly in the field of medicine, but also in that of natural history and theology. It was often equated with anatomy, that is restricted to anatomy, and then we're dealing with human body. But originally, for instance, in the first reference, 1501, you have a clear object that deals with the human body and the soul. So, of course, important to realize that today, the view we have of anthropology is totally different, because anthropology is an overarching concept, which is due to the reshuffling of the anthropological landscape in France, Britain, and the USA in the 1860s and 70s. If you like, we can talk about that later. But it is in this period that a rearrangement of the relation between anthropology and ethnology took place, in which anthropology was seen as a general science and ethnology was subordinated for being part of anthropology. And this is how the celebrated four-field approach to anthropology came about, which, however, did not exist before the 1860s and 1870s when it was formed. And I find it interesting that in the four-field method, which is physical anthropology, ethnology, and prehistoric archaeology and linguistics, ethnography is not mentioned separately, although it is surely at the basis of ethnology and of sociocultural anthropology, as we say today. But in Europe, these two fields were separate, physical and anthropology and ethnology. They remained separate, usually, although there were attempts to link them. And this is a pattern that continued until the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, that in Europe, both in Eastern and in Western Europe, these fields were separate, physical anthropology being done by physicians and natural historians, ethnology being done by cultural historians, linking it to linguistics, archaeology, and cultural history. This was a pattern that in Europe you have like a two-field approach, more or less, in which basically scholars specialize in either one of those, never in four.
Now, who was polymath Gottfried Leibniz, and what was the significance of his meeting, as well as his correspondence with Tsar Peter the Great and associates during and after the Grand Embassy? In your response, if you can, please try to address at least three of the following: his so-called four tasks, his correspondence with Ludolf, his rules and principles of sufficient reason and continuity, his primals as Aramaic language, divine significations in a harmony of language, what Leibniz meant by the origin of the American and then world nations, as well as his 1711 to 1712 idea for historical linguistics.
Thank you. Yes, Leibniz is the topic of my second chapter, and I begin with him because Leibniz developed a field he called historical linguistics, or in his terms, historia etymologica, which was at the basis, I think, of ethnography and ethnology, in fact, made it possible to develop these fields, because Leibniz was extremely interested in the historical comparison of languages in order to establish their relationship. The relations between nations could be established by investigating their languages. And in order to pursue this aim, Leibniz entered in enormous correspondence with scholars throughout Europe up until Russia, in order to get the data and get language specimens so that he could continue this work. And in my book, I see this as the founding stone for ethnology and ethnography, because it provides a value-free basement for comparing peoples. And this was the main interest of Leibniz. How are these people related? And he connected this, of course, with the origin. This is interesting. The origin of humanity is not, as the Bible taught us, with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, because this was speculative. Scholars in the early Enlightenment, such as Leibniz and his followers later, Müller, Schlözer, they didn't want to enter into the debate about that, because they knew it was very sensitive. So they started from Noah and the Ark of Noah after the flood, and this is why they took up the story. And then, of course, they had to link not only these people, not these historians were doing it, but everybody took their lineage up, their dynasty up, from one of the three sons of Noah. And this was the problem for the historians. How do we connect living peoples today with these three sons of Noah? And that was why Leibniz entered into this problem. And it was interesting that he developed a proto-language. He invented the proto-Adamic language. This is one of the cornerstones of comparative linguistics even today. He had this concept that there needs to be something before Adam, because he refuted the thesis that Hebrew was the first language, the first and original language. There should have been something before that, because of the relationship between the Semitic languages, Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, and so on. There should have been a predecessor. And he built up his work like that, and then started to collect these language specimens in Sweden, in Italy, everywhere, in Spain, the Basque language, and so on. He also entered into a relationship with the Chinese, the missionaries, the Jesuit missionaries in China, and with the court of Peter the Great in St. Petersburg and Moscow, in order to get language specimens from what he called Tartary. This is the area now called Siberia, and it had all the interest in it. In this context, I can point to a new book that was written by Michael Carhart, which is a sort of a prequel to my chapter 2. It's called Leibniz Discovers Asia, Social Networking in the Republic of Letters. And it's wonderful because Carhart takes it up from 1692 on, how Leibniz contacts the Tsar and his associates and all kinds of people working in Russia in order to get these language specimens. Of course, in my own book, I mentioned that Leibniz met Peter the Great at least six times on four different occasions in the year 1711 till 1716, the year that he died. And he was even hired as a counselor for Russia. And he was pretty successful in his scholarly attempts, not only with the comparative linguistics, but also in the geographical exploration of the Russian Empire and the question whether Asia and America were connected by a land bridge or whether there was an open sea lane, and also with the founding of the Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg.
Given his three steps, the botany mammoth data, and observations of Siberian ritual and material cultures, as well as dialects. Why do you consider the next German scholar, Daniel Messerschmidt, as the first, at least after the 1718 Erskine contract, Forschungsschreinschunder, the first Forschungsschreinder, despite research repossession by a post-Petrine Kunstkamera? And what were his influences?
Yes. Well, Messerschmidt is not my term to call him the first Forschungsreisende. This is he's called like that, the first explorer of Siberia by East German historians of science who edited his work or his journal of his trip in the 1950s and 60s, entering into a dialogue with their Russian colleagues under socialism and so on. And they had this project of editing Messerschmidt's work because they were extremely impressed by the way he had carried out his research expedition. And they used the word Forschungsreisender, which literally translates as a research traveler, somebody taking part in a research expedition. And Messerschmidt led his own expedition in Siberia up to Mongolia and China, accompanied by a few students and assistants, a cook, a hunter, and so on. And during the first year of this expedition, which lasted from 1719 to 1727, 8 years underway, he was accompanied by a Swedish prisoner of war he had picked up in Tobolsk, the center of Siberia. And his name was Tabart, who later adopted the name von Strahlenberg, so Tabart von Strahlenberg, who also published a book in 1830. And at that time, of course, Siberia had been conquered by the Cossacks a full century earlier, beginning in 1581. So in the 1719, this research was post-conquest. Situation was secure to travel, although pretty hard, by sledge or horse on the rivers and so on. And Messerschmidt managed to conclude this expedition successfully. And he had collected so much material that it took scholars, including Müller, the historian, 2 weeks to arrange them and make an inventory. Because Messerschmidt had been sent out with an instruction to collect in 6 or 7 fields. He was, of course, trained as a physician, taking a PhD in Halle in 1713. And he was instructed to study the geography of the country, the natural history, its medicine, including medicinal plants and diseases. Furthermore, the people and their languages, their monuments and antiquities, and everything remarkable. This was his charge. And then halfway through his journey in 1724, he organized his notes during a winter break, divided them into 7 categories: geography, philology, monuments and antiquities, mineralogy, botany, zoology, and medicine. Now, as ethnography is not included in this list, I conclude that this research was fundamental but preparatory for the genesis of ethnography. He didn't have that as a category itself. Needless to say, that GDR historians, they hailed the systematic way in which Messerschmidt had collected and arranged his collections. And he indeed had 3 steps in his work schedule. First, to observe in the field along the way, then to record the data that could only be done in a tent, as he says, and a third step to analyze and report and catalog everything that could be done in a large room, that is, during a winter break. These 3 steps. And I would say Messerschmidt's work was proto-ethnographic. What he collected has not been separately published, although some of the objects he collected many objects, attires and all kinds of stuff, mammoth bones and so on. It may have perished in the fire of the Kunstkamera, which was the Academy's museum in 1747. Of course, the Kunstkammer was established in 1717, but 30 years later it went up in flames, was rebuilt, and it's still standing there. It's now the Ethnographic Museum. And at the time, it contained all of the collections acquired during the research expeditions the Russians sent out in all kinds of directions. So Messerschmitt's expedition was only one of them, but it was the most scientific, scholarly, systematic that was really remarkable. And when the historian Gerhard Friedrich Müller, who I think is one of the founding fathers of ethnography, was invited to join a committee to arrange Messerschmitt's collections, he recalled that it exceeded all expectations to what extent the Kunstkammer had been expanded by indigenous natural specimens and artistic rarities collected by Messerschmitt. So this was a major step in the exploration of the Russian Empire up until the borders with Mongolia and China, and mainly about plants and medicine, zoology and so on, mineralogy, but also archaeology and language specimens. This is interesting. Messerschmitt set about collecting the language specimens that Leibniz needed, because it had long been gone, but to carry on this project.
Can you give us a little background on Gerhard Müller and in the context of the transition from ethnic history to Völkerbeschreibung, descriptive comparisons? What were his largely unpublished 1737 to 40 ethnographic instructions to the second Kamchatka expedition? Also, in the context of German scholars from the Russian Academy of Sciences, criticism of Russian conquests, what were examples of natural objects, material culture, and artistic renderings of Siberia in the Kunstkamera and that Ice Palace wedding?
Yes, the Ice Palace wedding. Well, I don't know too much about that, but there is a drawing, and there's a couple of references. It's well known in Russian history that some of the textiles collected from all parts of the Russian Empire were used as dresses for the so-called Ice Palace wedding, which was a mock wedding on the ice in front of the palace. In St. Petersburg, I think it was in 1725 or something like that, or a bit later, 27. And it was much fun because these textiles from all kinds of peoples of the Russian Empire were worn by the nobility assembled during this festival. And of course, it was at an order, an ukaz of the Tsarina, I think it was Anna, who would say, we're going to do a mock party and have fun. Unfortunately, some of these costumes, they returned broken and torn to the Kunstkammer, and the curators deplore what's happening. I'm not sure if these collections still exist because of the 1747 fire. I'm sure they don't. Like I said, the building was more or less spared, but the collections went up in smoke. So that's why later expeditions from the 1760s started collecting new. And also many collections acquired during the second Kamchatka expedition, in which Müller took part. This was executed in 1733 till 1743. Were lost also due to this fire, which hampers research, of course. Now about Müller. Gerhard Friedrich Müller was a German historian from West Germany, the Rhine area, who had studied at Leipzig in East Germany and who joined the Russian Academy in 1725, 6 weeks before the Academy of Sciences was inaugurated. He arrived as a very young boy, I think he was 20, He just finished his master, or maybe not even finished his master in history. And he was hired as an adjunct in the Academy of Sciences, teaching at the gymnasium, Latin and Greek and so on, slowly learning Russian. And after a couple of years, he applied to take part in this expedition. This was the second Bering expedition. And he was hired as a historian and as a geographer. But during the expedition, he turned into an ethnographer, because before taking off from St. Petersburg in 1733, Müller had written an instruction, as all the academics in this, there was a small group of academics, and they were required to write instructions of what they were going to do. And Müller was working together with an astronomer, Delisle, and with a natural historian, Gmelin. And between Gmelin and him, he had divided the field. So if the astronomer does the calculations in geography, physical geography, astronomy, then Gmelin and Müller were going to do the natural history of Siberia, and Müller was going to do the civil history, the political history, the social history, as we would say now, historia civilis. And there was the distinction between them and how they cooperated, and they helped each other along the way. Now, it's interesting that Müller produced three sorts of manuscripts on this expedition, which were largely unpublished at the time. Most of the materials from the academic party of the Second Kamchatka expedition remained in manuscript. They were kept locked and hidden in the academy archives in the Kunstkamera. But he had made a distinction between three fields, not only to collect in the field of history and of geography, but also in that what we would now call ethnography. In fact, what Müller called Völkerbeschreibung, a description of peoples, and what a few years later in 1767 was called ethnographia, which is the first occurrence of the word. And during this expedition, Müller developed methods and instructed other members of the expedition, both German and Russian and other nationalities, students, assistants, to describe the peoples in this way. Müller himself carried out ethnographic research himself, apart from history and geographical research. He visited all regional centers, interviewed specialists such as shamans and chiefs, collected historical, archaeological, geographical, ethnological, statistical, and linguistic materials, including word lists of all peoples encountered. So he did encompassing field work in as much as possible during this trip, and he instructed other members to do the same. To give one example, if Müller was going somewhere where Gmelin couldn't go, or vice versa, that Müller would do the natural history collecting as much as he could for Gmelin. And if Gmelin was traveling somewhere where Müller couldn't go because they had separate journeys to the north, to the south, whatever, then Gmelin collected information on the peoples that he encountered. And this was the same with the assistants that they had, which primarily Krasheninikov, a Russian student who was sent to Kamchatka and who lived there for 3.5 years to carry out the instructions that Müller and Gmelin had given him, namely to collect comprehensively in the field of natural history and in what Müller called the Beschreibung des Sibirischen Völker. And there were a couple of these people on Kamchatka and the islands surrounding and the continent. This, Kamchatka is, of course, the peninsula. So Krasheninikov had lots of work, and he reported on that. It was published, one of the few publications that came out was published in 1755. Of course, also the work of Gmelin was published, but Müller's work remained in manuscript until it came out in the 2000s, 2009, 10, 18, and so on. And there was one other assistant. His name is Steller. He also was sent to Kamchatka by Müller and by Gamelin in order to oversee the work of Krasheninikov, who was a younger student. And he produced a work on Kamchatka, which was published in 1773, which includes half of the book is about the natural history of Kamchatka and the vicinity. But the other half deals with the peoples and their manners and customs and languages and religion and so on. And this book, both books by Krasheninikov and Stella, are extremely helpful in today's revival of culture of the Itamenes on Kamchatka, the main population group there, doing their festivals and so on. It's extremely valuable research. But the point that I am making in my book is that these people worked at the instruction of Müller in order to gather the data that he needed for his comparative ethnographic program. Because Müller, like Messerschmidt, had three steps in his work process. First, to make a comprehensive descriptions of all of the peoples of Siberia, of all aspects of all peoples of Siberia. Second, to make a comparison between these descriptions of these peoples of Siberia, and third, to make a comparison between these descriptions and those of peoples of other continents. And that is a full program that I call an ethnological program of Müller, and in which this concept of Völkerbeschreibung of his is very central. So on the basis of this, his methods, the method that he designed along the way of interviewing and how not to interfere with cultures and the people, how to enlist their support and how to go about collecting everything from textiles and word list, do excavations as much as possible. This is a complete scholarly program, which I'd say is at the basis of ethnography even today.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Please briefly trace shifts in Müller's ethno-linguistic perspectives. And if at all possible, please try to address at least three of the following. His 1728 organization of Messerschmidt's findings, which you've already alluded to, I guess. The influence of Joseph François Lafetau's reciprocal illumination. Those 1730s to 40s articles. The Nachrichten field notes. The incomplete Beschreibung. And Müller's critique of travel accounts.
Thank you. Yeah, well, Müller turned into an ethnographer during the expedition. It's interesting that this is the same way it went with Boas. Boas became an ethnographer during fieldwork in the field of geography. But Müller had the same experience, a relatively young person, underway in an enormous terrain, meeting all kinds of people. Dressed differently, different languages, different religions, at least four religions in Siberia, like Protestants, Orthodox, Muslims, Buddhists. So and he encountered them all. And then he turned into an ethnographer due to his program to collect this Historia Gentium, as he called it, in 1732, and Völkerbeschreibung in 1740, to describe these peoples as completely as possible. And Müller motivated this in a preface that Müller made two manuscripts along the way. One, a description of Siberian peoples in the order in which he had visited them, had encountered them. This is in chronological order. But he used this manuscript for another manuscript, the comparative manuscript, comparing some manners and customs of several tribes, or Völker, as he called them, of Siberia, in a thematic way. You know, he had a category of the shamans in Kamchatka, among the Tungus, among the Yakut, and so on and so on. And these manuscripts remained unpublished until 1710 and 1718, 2010 and 2018. But they were probably used by people having access to the academy archives, such as later explorers. They used, just as Müller's manuscript was used by Pallas and others, Messerschmidt's manuscript were also used. These were books that one could use if you got access, and you could build on that. So there was tremendous influence between these explorers, and they built on the same program. Whereas Messerschmidt had done his primarily natural historian and linguistic way, Müller carried it forward and adopted Leibniz's method for the historical comparison of peoples, built it into his program, and he carried that forward. He collected, and he asked his students and assistants to collect these vocabularies, and get into the grammar as much as they could, and so on, in order to make these comparisons possible. Now, if in doing this, Müller had one important example, and this was the work of Lafitau, who in 1725 had published this work on the American Indians compared to the peoples of antiquity. And this was a major example for Müller. He wanted to do what for Siberia, what Lafitau had done, and others for the Americas and the American Indians. Native Americans were described, of course, by Spanish Jesuits in Southern America and Central America, and by the Spanish and the French historians and Jesuits in Northern America up to Canada. And this is where Lafitau had worked. And this work was so important to Müller that he took it along on his way, and this was the main example. So that's why I say the German explorers working in Siberia at the time were trying to fill this terra incognita in the way that Lafitau had made this comparative study, and this was very important. And it's interesting that Müller in a preface to this thematic manuscript on the comparison of Siberian peoples made a remark that he had a sort of a dream. I quote, "An experienced person would compile a most general description of peoples, and that from this comparison, from this general description of peoples, a new science would be founded, eine gewisse neue Wissenschaft begründet werden möge. And that would be beneficial to posterity forever." This is from a preface published in 2010 in the Müller's Beschreibung der Völker, Siberische Völker. And this is what characterized the person. He was contributing to a certain new science in the future, eine gewisse neue Wissenschaft. And this is what we call ethnology or sociocultural anthropology today.
Please also elucidate Müller's contributions to ethnography. I mean, especially given his impact on Kamchatka expedition successor Johann Fischer, as well as, you've already mentioned, the Steller, Stepan Krasenikov. ethnography in the 1768 to 1774 Russian academic expeditions, Johann Georgi and Mikhail Speransky, but also given the second expedition's lack of a direct impact on Russian colonial administration despite utilitarian aims.
Yes, well, Müller was extremely influential, not only during the expedition, but his instructions, and people did listen to these instructions because at least six sources can be found, can be traced, six works of people, Krasheninikov, Steller, Lindenau, Gmelin, Fischer, and there was another, Gorlanov. They followed his instructions. So during the expedition, he was influentially carried out the research program that he set. But also afterwards, because in 1768, 1747, there were new expeditions being undertaken, sent out by the Russian Academy of Sciences. And these were led by people, naturalists, or there was five groups led by naturalists in all directions of the Russian Empire, including Western and Eastern Siberia, but also Mongolia, the borders with Mongolia and the Caucasus and Southern Russia, where the Volga area. And these were led by Pallas, Lepyokhin, another, the nephew of Gmelin, Güldenstadt, and a man called Falk, who was a student from Linnaeus. And they carried the same program, although they were principally interested in natural history. And this was a project by that time greatly supported by Catherine the Great, who had recently adopted the position of Tsarina. And she supported this project, sending out new expeditions to collect for the benefit of the empire, but also to renew the collections of the Kunstkammer, form new collections in the field of natural history and what we call now cultural history. So archaeology, linguistics, ethnography, and so on. And this was extremely successful because these books were published. I give one example. Pallas's work was published even while he was underway. You know, the first and second volume of his travelogue appeared while he was still traveling in some corner of Siberia. And the work of Falk, a student of Linnaeus, was also published later on. He concentrated on natural history, but indeed had 30 descriptions of peoples that he had encountered. So this ethnographic program was part of these so-called academic expeditions sent out in 1768. And then one of the people assisting Falk during these expeditions was a man called Georgi, who published Falk's work as well as his own travel report, and he also made a description of all peoples of the Russian Empire, which in 1778 appeared in a Russian, a French, and a German edition, and was even reprinted in a second Russian expedition in the late 18th century, who was illustrated by cuts of all the important peoples of Siberia. And this was a general description of all peoples of the Russian Empire, which amounted to a veritable ethnography. And Russians today, Russian anthropologists today, see this as the beginning of their science. Of course, I point to the importance of Müller, because Müller was an advisor for this project. He helped Pallas, he helped the individual scholars in forwarding their collections to and from Moscow to Petersburg and so on. He was an intermediary, he was central even in this expedition, and Pallas, of course, had consulted with him how to go about and probably read some of his work in the Academy of Archives. So this project, this program of Müller was carried forward not only during the second Kamchatka expedition, but also during these later academic expeditions. It was carried forward. And that means that it was very successful. Of course, in another way too, because of Schlözer, who had stayed with Müller in St. Petersburg and then returned to Göttingen to publish as much as he could. So we will deal with that a bit later. But the other question that you mentioned, yes, all of these expeditions had utilitarian aims to forward the benefit of the Russian Empire and to collect stuff that could be useful to the Russian state. In fact, a territorial expansion was the least of it, but also the peoples that lived there would be taxed, and the Russian administration needed data. So this is a complicated question about the relationship between anthropology and colonialism, a debate, you know, in anthropology from the 1960s on. And I take a moderate standpoint here. I said Müller and the other explorers were not working for the Russian administration in Siberia. They were working for the Academy of Sciences, and they were scholars reporting to the Academy of Sciences directly and collecting to that aim. And secondly, they didn't have any rank in a Russian military or a colonial administration, were in fact regarded as a big nuisance because of the shortage of supplies and so on. What are we going to have to do with them? Secondly, there's no evidence that their reports, for instance, written in German or in Swedish, or, you know, were even consulted by these administrators, whether they did have any impact on the Russian policy, colonial policies in the Siberian provinces and so on. So I asked a specialist, Peter Hoffmann, one of the best informed historians of 18th century German-Russian relations, and he denies that there was any impact on administrative practice. He says the results of the second Kamchatka expedition were purely scientific, had no immediate impact, and the officials of the Siberian department took no interest in the scholarly research, saw the expedition as a burden without any practical use. So initially there was no impact. Whether there was any impact of the later academic expeditions is also not explored. Nobody knows about it. But there was a later impact when Michail Speransky, reformed the administration of Siberia in the 1820s, and he used Georgi's ethnographic work that I've just mentioned from the 1770s, which in fact in turn was based on that of Müller in the 1730s and 1740s. And Speransky's reform policies evidently profited from the ethnographies of peoples that had been made available during the preceding century. So Speransky also initiated new research. It's clear that he used their work as a basis for the reforms that he took, which included splitting Siberia into departments and so on, and wanting the people to settle, the nomads to settle, and all of this. So there's gigantic impact on the ethnological composition of the country by Russian administrators, and maybe even to the good for some of them due to Speransky's reforms, before that, there's no evidence that there was any concrete link between the ethnographer's reports and the colonial administration in Siberia.
What was the significance of that multidisciplinary Danish-German scientific Arabian expedition organized at the Wolfian University of Göttingen?
Well, the German expedition to the Danish-German expedition to Yemen was an important event, which took place in the 1760s, likewise as the academic expeditions a bit earlier, than the academic expeditions in Russia. But it was quite different. It was what you could say a totally scientific expedition without any utilitarian aims, because there was no business, there was nothing in Yemen that these scholars were investigating. There were no trade relations between Denmark, the Danish state was funding this expedition, and it had been organized by a man called Johan David Michaelis in Göttingen, who was an Orientalist, who set out a plan to visit historic places mentioned in the Bible, which was difficult, of course, to find 2,000-year-old remnants of historic places in the Middle East of the 1760s. But it was an interesting and important expedition, in which a couple of also multidisciplinary. There was a natural historian, Forskal, from Sweden. There was a philologist from Germany, von Haven, collecting manuscripts and supposedly doing interviews and so on. And there was Carsten Niebuhr, who was an astronomer and geographer, set out to make the cartography of the area. And he was the sole survival. Now, Niebuhr is an extremely interesting author, whose two books have appeared after the expedition. He was the only survivor, and he also published the work of his compatriots. And it's very interesting. He gives a travelogue and a description of the territory visited, which includes parts of Turkey and Egypt, up until Arabia and Yemen, which was the penultimate, the end aim of the expedition. So it is extremely rich in notes on everything that he saw and found, but I'd say it's more like a proto-ethnography. It is not comparable to the work that Müller did and Pallas and Georgi did in the Russian Empire, because that wasn't his aim. I mean, Niebuhr was not ordered to make a comprehensive description of peoples in the Ottoman Empire. That's a big difference. And in addition, the Ottomans would not have been interested in such descriptions of people making such descriptions. They didn't have a brief to do that. And this is the main difference with the work conducted by Müller and Pallas Georgi in the Russian Empire and Niebuhr and other cases. Proto-ethnographic, interesting, containing all kinds of notes about manners and customs and institutions, but not a comprehensive systematic in the way that Müller set out to make a complete description of all aspects of all peoples of the Russian Empire. So they think I use this as a counter case in my book to get this clear, what Müller was about.
In the context of ethnographie and ethnography, who was, you've already alluded to him, August Ludwig Schlüsser, and what was his legacy, even for his contentions on Slavs autochthonous to Germany? In your response, please try to address at least three of the following: his conception of the Vulcan historical world system, his introduction of ethnographisch, his Leibniz comparative historical linguistics, his Michelsian textual historical philology, his Linnaean Philosophia Ethnographica for non plus ultra Northern Europeans, as well as his ethnocritical Völkerkunde.
Thank you. Yes. Well, Schlüsser was a German historian from Franconia who had studied at Göttingen University, among others, with Michaelis, from which he learned this method of historical philology, of editing text, codices of text, and Schlüsser later applied that in editing the Nestor Chronicle from the 11th to the 15th century, 10 codices, and got very famous for this work. Before that, in his earlier work, he was more into the comparative linguistics of Leibniz, which he enriched by importing the model of Linnaeus. And Schlüsser was important the history of ethnography and Völkerkunde, because he was the first person to even use this word Völkerkunde. He introduced it. Schlözer had been an assistant in Müller's house as a home teacher for Müller's sons for 6 months, and then he separated himself to set himself up as a researcher and later as a professor at the Academy of Sciences, working on Russian history, which is how we found these Nestor Chronicles. And then through Fischer, who was sent to replace Müller during the second expedition, but then independently made his own way, and also as a historian collected language specimens and other stuff, which he published in 1771. Schlözer was very interested in the work of Müller and Fischer and the others done during the second Kamchatka expedition. And he published this in a manuscript, in a book called Allgemeine Nordische Geschichte in 1771, in which he used these concepts, ethnologia, ethnography, Völkerkunde, ethnograph, or the ethnographies. He published this in his work at least 20 times that these concepts occur. And this was the book I found in Leiden, which convinced me that Hans Fischer was on the right track in pointing to Göttingen, but missing the point with Gatterer, because Schlözer had been more important than Gatterer, because Schlözer had traveled to Russia himself. He had seen, he'd been in Sweden, he later traveled to Italy and to France. So he was not an explorer, but he was a traveler. And he was a synthesist, incorporating all of the knowledge that he could assemble in St. Petersburg in this book, Allgemeine Nordische Geschichte, in which he connected the European North and the Asian North in one big 600-page volume, extremely interesting work. And in this work, he comes up with the idea to come to a Systema Populorum, which is a reference to Linnaeus' Systema Naturae, which Schlözer then applies to this to what he calls a Völker system in world history. Schlözer was a world historian, and he saw this one of the first world historians in German Enlightenment. He an universal Gelehrter working in the field of universal Geschichte. And in this context, the European and the Asian North were important because they lacked, and there were so many confusions and fakeness about it. So he introduced an ethnographic method. It's one of four methods of world history. The first ones are chronographic, ethnographic, and geographic, and then ethnographic would be the fourth method to be used by history in order to arrange the history of peoples, ethnographies. And this is the way he went about coining these terms. Of course, the idea of Systema Populorum, which was also adopted by Gatterer, his colleague, Völkersystem, and then nach Linnaeischer Methode verfertigt das Systema Populorum in classes and ordinis, genera, species. So he's using the linguistic method of Leibniz and the Linnaean method of natural history to make up some kind of new synthesis in which ethnography had a central role to play. And it was very important that he came to results in this, which were very, very, very influential, because he had hundreds of students. The brothers Grimm, Humboldt, Georg Forster, they all followed his lectures. He had successors. He also influenced Kolar, the Slovak Socrates in Vienna. And he is very well known, but not so much for his ethnographic importance. The fact that he was the first to introduce this term, Völkerkunde, has not been taken up, as far as I know, by many people, because I don't know, this is sort of a lack of interest in Germany for this kind of history of science in in anthropology today.
So moving to the next caller, who was Adam Kolar and how did his 1783 definition of ethnologia diverge from the Enlightenment conjectural tradition?
Well, Kolar was, as I said, a Slovak scholar from Slovakia, who was born in the monarchy of Hungary, and then, as a historian, landed on the top position at the Kunst Library in Vienna. So he was the main historian in the Austrian-Hungarian territories, overlooking the field, and he had the same kind of interest as Schlözer had. That's a direct relationship between these people. They knew each other's work, and they did the same kind of things. And then I think that Kolar adopted Schlözer's Völkerkunde and built it into a term called ethnologia. This happened previously, I forgot to mention that under the previous question, with one of Schlözer's relatives, whose name was Schöpelin, and who probably learned from Schlözer that there should be a thing called Völkerbeschreibung in Müller's case, which Schlözer made into Völkerkunde, a more general study of peoples. And it needed a Greek equivalence in order to be accepted in a scholarly terminology. And this was being done by a Latinist and Greek scholars, relatives of Schlözer in Nördlinge, called Schöpelin and Thilo, who were the first to use this term ethnographia in 1767. And then Kolar made the move from Völkerkunde, Schlözer's Völkerkunde, to ethnologia, first in 1781, and then he supplied the definition in 1783, which is extremely interesting, because the short definition is that he says ethnologia ethnotitia gentium populorumque. This means ethnologia is a science or study of peoples and nations. But if you see the rest of the definition, it includes the origins, languages, customs, legal institutions, and ancient settlements of nations. And in addition, this ethnologia had a practical purpose to improve evaluations of peoples and nations in its own area. As Kolar says, in order to be able better to judge the peoples and nations in their own times. This is 1783 in Vienna. And of course, Vienna, like the Russian Empire, like St. Petersburg, is the capital of a multi-linguistic and multi-ethnic empire with a multitude of people under its regime. And if somebody in the court library in Vienna overlooking the field comes to such a definition, it means something. It's extremely important also that he combines two words for the same thing. He says, notitia gentium populorumque, a science of peoples and nations, or if you could say, tribes and nations. And that's interesting, because in the first case, the Latin word gens is people that are homogeneous. It's a homogeneous set of people. The other case, populus, is a composite, peoples that are heterogeneous. There are several gens in one populus. And Kolar includes both of these views from Latin in this one definition. And with this distinction between gens and populus and the rest of his definition, I think Kolar consciously indicated the complexity of the subject. And this is a very, 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 very good view that we can build on today, because the situation, of course, in ethnology and anthropology is extremely complex today. There's all kinds of people moving. There's all kinds of relations. It is not as simple as one would expect, given the definition of Völkerkunde as such, you know, the study of peoples. Now Kolar says there's several sorts of peoples that Schlözer would have agreed to. Forgot to mention that, but Schlözer distinguished three views of people, a geographical view, a historical or genetic view, and a political view, that is, people living in a country or living as a tribe, as a stam, what he calls it, or within a state. And Kulayev does the same thing. He makes it very complex and very influential, because this is the way it went about in the world. Now, this diverges from the conjectural history, as you mentioned, because a traditional at the time was to think in terms of progress, stage-like progress. And there's all kinds of scholars being associated with the tradition. In France, you have Rousseau, Turgot, Boulanger. In Scotland, you have Ferguson, Millar, Dunbar, Falconer, and Robertson, Lord Kames. You have Jens Kraft in Denmark, Isaac Islin and Chavan in Switzerland, and Herder and Forster, Georg Forster in Germany. Adam Smith formulated the theory of the four stages of human progress. And this tradition, the conjectural tradition, remained influential until the 19th century and stood at the basis of social evolutionism, you know, with the savages and the barbarians and the development of the civilization. This is a stage-like progress, developmental model. And this is a quite different approach from that of Leibniz, Müller, Schlözer, and Kolar, who compared peoples on the basis of their languages instead of their customs and institutions. And the ethno-linguistic approach, inspired by Leibniz, became a tradition in the German-speaking countries and in the USA, by the way. It was less speculative and less judgmental. The approach reflected on the ethnic diversity in the world rather than judge a people's way of life from a moralistic high ground in which civilized was favored over savage and barbaric. In contrast to the conjectural tradition, the tradition of Müller, Schlözer, Gasser, and Kolar was ethnological. And this is the importance of this tradition.
Further, what was Johann Herder, a scholar who's gotten a lot of press recently, what was Herder's relativist perspective on Schlözer's view of ethnography, especially given Herder's arguments about the originality of folk life, the unicity of individuals in natural law, Herder's rejection of race, but then also his later appropriation by nationalists?
Well, Herder is often seen as one of Franz Boas' ancestors. Boas mentioned him in his lecture on the history of anthropology. And he's also seen as a forerunner of Romanticism. But I think the real Herder is that he's very, very conscious of the power of peoples and nations of the subject of Müller, Schlözer, and the others. Yet he showed little respect for Schlözer's terms. He didn't like this word ethnographic. Instead, he used more poetic terms such as the painting of nations or a painting of the diversity of our species. This is what it's like. Herder was a theologian, in fact, a priest, working on the field of world history and regional history. Of course, he began to collect folk songs in 1772. So he's a different character than Schlözer, his opponent, you could say, his adversary. Now, Herder is seen by some, Isaiah Berlin, for instance, as belonging to the romantic countercurrent to the Enlightenment. But in fact, he was in the tradition of the French and Scottish Enlightenment, in which historians and philosophers used ethnographic data to support their theories about the development of humankind, which is, like I said, the conjectural history approach. Herder is also regarded as having influenced the national awakening in Eastern Europe during the early 19th century, and it's true that he was appropriated by the nationalists striving for a separate state, specifically in Eastern Europe, the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy and so on. He's, I think, one of the most interesting historians of the 18th century, and his main works, the Idee and the Briefe zur Beförderung der Humanität, extremely important works in which he presented a relativist vision of world history, in which the humaneness, humanitate was a central concept. He devised a teleological view of people's unfolding towards humaneness. People are bound to become more humane. And that is an important vision of world history. Now, on the other hand, he's seen more of an anthropologist than an ethnologist by historians of science such as John Samito, who claims that Herder founded anthropology and he was the most complete anthropologist of the 18th century. Together with Kant, his teacher in Königsberg, they were working on the same subject. Anthropology was born out of philosophy. So what Samito is talking about is philosophical anthropology. And that is an important subject. But it's not ethnology, it's the study of ethnic diversity. It's a different subject. So I'm very interested in Herder. But in my book, I give him more of a side spot. Probably less than he would deserve.
Can you elucidate Johann Gatterer's linkages between geography and ethnography and the development of Volkskunde folklore? And what about the German coupling of ethnography with geography, the first journals and encyclopedias that featured Volkskunde, edited mostly by young Germans, and the editor Theophil Ehrmann's distinctions between ethnology, ethnography and Volkskunde.
Yeah, well, you mentioned this historian Gatterer. He was Schlözer's senior colleague, who was the second to use the words Volkskunde and ethnographia in his work. Gatterer was also a historian, but he saw geography as important for history. In fact, he called geography and chronology as history's two eyes. Now, in one of his handbooks on geography, published in 1775, he gave the study of humans and peoples a joint place in his classification of geographical sciences. He calls it Menschen und Völkerkunde, and then between brackets, Anthropographia and Ethnographia. Anthropography and ethnography. He linked. And he gave him a fourth place in his classification of geographical sciences. He also gave a table of contents, what the study should entail. And he was aware that some of the peoples studied by this discipline do not have a written history. He wrote that in 1773. For this reason, they could not be included in the study of history proper, but only in an auxiliary discipline, namely geography. So we have an interesting view. In the case of Müller, ethnography is separated from history and geography. So there's three subjects that he's doing. In the case of Schlözer, he's saying ethnography is a part of history. There should be ethnographic method is part of history. And Gatterer says, well, we better relegate it to a place, give it a place in geography. Now, this, of course, has become a strong combination of Länder und Völkerkunde, of geography and ethnography, and there's a whole tradition of literature up until the 20th century. Even also in Holland, you have categories like Land and Völkerkunde in antiquarian bookshops, where you find books on travels and countries and ethnographic works in this category. And that is a pattern that started with Gatterer, and it was taken up by people such as Fabry, Norman, Sprengel in Halle and in Jena, and Ehrmann. Is also one of the people working in this field. It's the beginning of a rich tradition, ethnography as a new field linked with geography, very popular. And in Germany, this led to immense results in the early 19th century. For instance, there was an ethnographisches Archiv published in Jena in 39 volumes, and then Berghaus, the geographer, took it up. it developed into something big. Ethnography became big in the early 19th century, especially in connection with geography. So it's the beginning of a tradition. And that's how, of course, other people such as Bastian in Berlin and Tyler in Oxford took it up, could find it. It became a subject.
Can you briefly elaborate conceptually on anthropologia as a science of humans rather than a study of peoples through the 18th century? In your brief elaboration, please try to address the five types of anthropology in the German Enlightenment, Linnaean racial classifications, the racial hierarchies advanced by Buffon and Blumenbach, as well as, of course, Immanuel Kant's 1775 to 1788 article trilogy on race that distinguished between varieties of peoples and four germ races. Please also, if you can, please briefly address Christoph Meiner's attempt to substantiate racial classifications with ethnology, Ehrman's map, and Georg Forster's debates with Kant.
Ha! Well, that's an enormous subject that you mentioned. Yeah, that you open. Well, I opted to put a long chapter on anthropology in the German Enlightenment in my book, which deals with the emergence of and the genesis of ethnography and ethnology. It's explained with Müller, Schlözer, Kollar. But in order to introduce this to an American audience, which is used to the four-field approach and associates anthropology either with physical anthropology or as a general term for the subject, I needed to pay attention to anthropology also in 18th century Germany, because ethnology and ethnography were a new field, but anthropology was a well-established field, more or less. There's been research that there's at least five kinds of anthropology in 18th century Germany, namely medical, theological, philosophical, pedagogical, and physical anthropology, all present in the 18th century. And there's somebody who made a count that he found at least 80 titles of books with anthropology in the title published in this period in the 18th century. And that's a lot more than Völkerkunde, ethnography. So it was a big field. But it was also very much imprecise. Nobody really knew about that. Yeah. And then one branch of this whole variety of anthropologies in the 18th century became dominant. And this is the field of physical anthropology. Of course, philosophical anthropology became important too. Medical anthropology is extremely important today. But in the 18th century, physical anthropology came to steal the field, more or less. And it began with Linnaeus' classification of human varieties, later called races. Linnaeus classified humanity in four varieties, more or less corresponding to the four continents. So Africa, Asia, Europe, and America. And that's interesting that it's only that, and it's based on skin color, and more or less that's the main characteristic. But it was taken over by Buffon, the French naturalist, who also distinguished these four categories or varieties that he called race, la race, race humaine. And then later by Blumenbach, who added a fifth variety. Now, this is a very long story, and I don't think we have enough time to go into all of that. But the broad outline is this. Buffon was very influential, and his natural history, it was enormously popular in entire Europe, in many volumes and in many editions. And there's a historian of science, Michel Duchet. She says that Buffon founded anthropology as a general science of man with his Histoire naturelle, 1749. By making the transition from the human individual to the human species, this is how he inaugurated the statue of the natural history of man, l'histoire naturelle de l'homme. And this subject was taken up in Germany due to the traditions both by Kant and by Blumenbach. And then you have all kinds of comments by Meiners and Forster on this. And two things important. Kant was dissatisfied with the way Buffon had loosely used terminology. He borrowed the word Rassen from Buffon. It was unknown in Germany at the time, Rassen. He spelled it in the French way, not with two S's, but with a C, Rassen, statt Rassen with SS. So it was foreign. And he criticized him for not being systematic. And that's true, because Buffon was inconsistent in his terminology, speaking about the Tartar nation, but also the Tartar race, or of the black race, but also of the need to divide blacks into different races. So the blacks are race, but also you have several races in the black race. And this is a problem with Buffon that the Germans were very much aware of. Does he talk about a species or a genus and so on? And this is what Kant was going about. And it's regarded as the founder of the modern concept of race by Berlusconi and many other people. And this landed Kant in a huge conflict, debate with Meiners, who was a racist, and with Forster, Georg Forster, who was not a racist, because he'd been a well-traveled man who went with his father on the second trip around the world with James Cook. He'd seen many nations, and he was extremely interested in the combination of natural and cultural history, specialized and late in the natural history of mankind and so on. And this is an important and big subject. But at the end of the day, Blumenbach came out as the founder of physical anthropology because he included the fifth variety, namely the Malayan, based on the work of Johann Reinhold Forster, the father, who had also been with Cook and who'd noted two races in the Pacific, the Polynesian and the Melanesian, as we would say now. And this led Bloom that, oh, we need a fifth variety in the classification of Linnaeus and Buffon. And secondly, because he adopted the term anthropology as a synonym for Buffon's Natural History of Man. And in the third edition of his book, he equated anthropologia with the natural history of man of Buffon. And this is how the term and the limited definition of anthropology entered British scholarship through the translation of the third edition in 1865. And then in 1865, we landed in an entirely different field in Europe, particularly in France and Britain, where racial studies have become a big issue, much bigger than ethnography, and come to dominate the field to the extent that these so-called races are supposed to be more important than the nations and peoples ethnography is focusing on. So as a result of that, particularly of the William Edwards in Paris, 1829 and 1839, and then his successor, Paul Broca in France, whose ideas were extremely influential and taken up by many naturalists around Europe, particularly also in Britain. The idea is that anthropology is the more fundamental, the more general subject, and ethnology is a subordinated subject. And this is how it's going to be in England. You have a long battle between the ethnologicals of the Ethnological Society of London and the Anthropological Society of London. And then finally in 1871, it's decided let's call it an anthropological society, and ethnology is part of that. And this also happens in America. It's the heydays of racial studies, and it's seen as more important. And ethnology, the study of peoples, based on languages mostly, and culture, is subordinated to this racial discourse. And this is an important reason for publishing my book, because I think that the German German case proves that these studies in the 18th century were separated, were not subordinated to either one. Anthropology is a specialization in the field of medicine, theology, or natural history, and ethnology is a subject being developed by historians, geographers, and linguists, although in the case of Pallas, also by naturalists. Of course, there's also naturalists who do ethnography, although they usually tend to specialize on plants and animals.
So you've touched a number of topics in the next couple of questions. Let's actually move to Adolphe Bastien. Is that all right? Why do you consider Adolphe Bastien as the neo-Kantian founder of modern ethnology in the 1860s and 70s? Likewise, how and why did German Enlightenment ideas prompt German emigre Franz Boas's coalescence of comparative linguistics, historical particularism, and a neo-Kantian Herderian four-field approach into the study of all cultures, particularly within the context of the founding of U.S. modern anthropology beginning in the 1890s, while also maintaining cultural relativism?
Yeah, well, here's where we can indeed pick up the story again, because the other chapter with the mingling of racial and ethnic categories, language, the problem of language versus race, is very complicated. But the picture gets a bit clear when we enter the case of Boas and Bastien in Berlin in the 1870s, and to answer your first question, your second question first, I mean, Boas did not invent the four-field approach. He found it when he arrived in New York in 1886. The four-field approach was established by the Anthropological Society of Washington in 1879, and also formulated by Pitt Rivers in Oxford, the founder of the Pitt Rivers Museum in 1882. So this was already there when Boas arrived. And Boas, of course, he had studied physics and geography, and he came to anthropology, ethnography, through his field work in Canada, Baffinland, and the British Columbia, as well as a stint at the Berlin Museum of Ethnology directed by Bastien. So the four field were not Boas's making, although he reinforced them when he accepted a professorship in New York, and he started to encourage his students to do research in these four fields. In fact, Boas himself did research in these four fields. Now, your first question about Bastien, being the founder of ethnology. He's usually called that the founder of ethnology in Germany. But if we accept that ethnography and ethnology had started in the 18th century, then surely Bastien cannot have been the founder. I see Müller as one of the founders of systematic ethnography, and Bastien, who comes a century later, he must be something else. So in my book, I call them Bastien and Boas the founders of modern anthropology, but this term is reserved by Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown, the founders of social anthropology in Britain in the 1920s. So we need a different term than I suggested. We could call them Bastien and Boas the founders of classical anthropology. In America, in Germany, and with Marcel Mauss and Emile Durkheim in France, that would be a better solution. You have early anthropology, which is with Müller, Schlözer, Collard, then classical anthropology with Bastien Boas and Tyler and so on, and then modern anthropology with Malinowski and Radcliffe Brown. So for the rest, of course, I agree that cultural relativism was a very important tool for Boas to combat racism. And his upbringing in Germany and the search of racism and anti-Semitism in Germany may well have played a role in formulating his view, his idealist view of anthropology. But like I said, when he first conducted fieldwork among the Inuit of Baffinland, he turned into an ethnographer just as Müller had done during the second Kamchatka expedition. He was trained as a physicist and a geographer, but he became an ethnographer in the field, adding linguistics along the way. And some German commentators claim that Berlin at the time was a center of liberal ethnology, and that Boas took the liberal Berlin school, that is the anti-racist school, to the US, where it survived.
What are differences between anthropology and ethnology in study and practice after the 1989 fall of the Berlin Wall? Coming full circle back to the beginning.
I see. Well, that's covering a lot of centuries. But thank you for the opportunity to give a few comments on this. Of course, the fall of the wall led to a dramatic reshuffling of history in Europe and the rest of the world, Asia, Americas, and so on, due to the Cold War between these superpowers and so on. But if we apply this to anthropology, I think the landscape has diversified enormously. Because with the opening of the Iron Curtain, scholars from Eastern Europe presented themselves in Western Europe. And I can still remember at a conference of social anthropologists in Coimbra, Portugal in 1990, is that many ethnographers from Eastern Europe joined and entered into contact with Western colleagues that they couldn't have been able to do for years. And this showed that these ethnographers had been studying their own cultural traditions and those of national minorities for decades and were very, very, very willing to adopt new approaches and terminology. And then variants of the pattern established after World War II occurred because in Holland, for instance, after World War II, the field ethnology was renamed in cultural anthropology in 1953. And in France, Claude Lévi-Strauss named his chair at the Sorbonne social anthropology, whereas his predecessor, Marcel Mauss, had been professor of ethnology. So you have renamings taking place in Europe. And then the field of Volkskunde in Germany, it's being called National Ethnology in 1955. So you have a couple of renamings of the field following World War II. Now, after the end of the Cold War, the same thing happens. The unification of Germany and the opening of Eastern Europe led to a proliferation of new approaches. And this led, for instance, that ethnology, which in countries such as Croatia and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia had, under Soviet pressure, been redefined as ethnography, were again called ethnology, or adapted to Western European usage of social or cultural anthropology, in Europe generally now being a combined thing, where we do socio-cultural anthropology. We don't need to distinguish between British social anthropology or American cultural anthropology. We just do it all. And this is what's happened in these past 30 years. These name changes, of course, don't make it any easier for a historian of science to find out which subject one is talking about, what anthropology one is talking about. But if one focuses on the labels and the practices, the disciplinary practices, and the object of study, one sees a pattern. And this is that anthropology is the overarching concept, but it tends to homogenize rather than represent plurality. As in the case with Kolar, this whole idea of nation or peoples or nations, gens and populorum, is diverse. There is diversity, enormous diversity. And this is what one would expect anthropology to also respect and pay into account. This enormous diversity in these people. Some have states, some are suffering, some are very powerful, some are suppressing others in a powerful state. So anthropology, in order to be specific, needs an adjective, either social, cultural, historical, philosophical anthropology, or physical anthropology, feminist anthropology. We need anthropology needs an adjective. And that is why I say this whole tradition of ethnology and ethnography is extremely important. And you see this happening in Europe now. In a recent book that I was reviewing called European Anthropologists, these ethnographic, ethnological traditions are being specified separately. You have social, cultural anthropology, but still you have lots of ethnology going on. And this is interesting. Because I would say the dominant trend in all of these approaches is ethnography, which is not a discipline or not a method, such as participant observation, nor is it a book in the sense of an ethnographic monograph, but it is a research program. And the central focus of what ethnology and social cultural anthropology is about or should be about. And that is why it's so important to credit Gerhard Friedrich Müller and Schlözer and Kolar for setting up this program for describing and comparing peoples or nations, you know, like 280 years ago.
So I know your book is being translated currently in several or a couple different languages. What's next for you? What are you working on, any new projects?
Yes, at the moment I'm working on a German edition and on a Russian edition of the book, because, you know, ethnography started as a German discourse in Russian Empire, and I'd like the book to become available there so that scholars and students can study that and improve on that, because, you know, I'm not a specialist in Russian history, and I think they can expand on it and use it. And the same goes for German anthropologists. I think they can use it too. Majority of course, read English, but it would be better to have a German version and confront them with some basic facts.
Excellent. The book is Before Boas: The Genesis of Ethnography and Ethnology in the German Enlightenment. The paperback was published last year by University of Nebraska Press. Thank you, Dr. Vermeulen, for being on the show today. On behalf of Dr. Vermeulen, this has been a New Books in History production, a channel on the New Books Network. I hope you tune in next time.